This is a recording of the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission held on December 14, 2007. Should you have questions after listening to this recording, please call the FEC at 1-800-424-9530 or email us at info@fec.gov.
Good afternoon. I would like to open or begin the open meeting of the Federal Election Commission for December 14, 2007. The first item on our agenda this morning involves the correction and approval of the minutes. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the minutes of an open meeting of the Federal Election Commission of Thursday, December 6, 2007, before us as agenda document 0788.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. The second item on our agenda involves future meeting dates. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider a memorandum from me on future meeting dates.
And well-crafted one at that. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Now on to that document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval of the proposed meeting dates set forth in agenda document 0790.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0 once again. The third item on our agenda involves the draft final rule and explanation and justification on electioneering communications. Mr. Vice Chairman, we again have a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider memoranda on the explanation and justification for the electioneering communications rules, agenda document 0792 and 0792A.
Very good. The Vice Chairman has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. On to the substance. We have Tony Buckley, Margaret Pearl, and Ron Catwan here from General Counsel's office. Counsel, if you would like to proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document 07-92 is a draft final rule with explanation and justification implementing the U.S. Supreme Court decision in FEC versus Wisconsin Right to Life, Inc. On November 20th, 2007, the Commission approved changes to its rules regarding corporate and labor organization funding prohibitions for electioneering communications, contained in 11 CFR 114.2, 114.4, and 114.14, and also revisions to the electioneering communications reporting rules in 104.20. The Commission also approved a new section 114.15 detailing the exemption for certain electioneering communications from the funding provisions under WRTL. The draft explanation and justification before you today is based upon those rules approved on November 20th. In addition to explaining the operation of these new rules, the draft ENJ includes examples of communications that would be permissible under the new exemption and examples of communications that would not be. The rules will become effective immediately upon publication in the Federal Register, and we'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Any discussion? I mean, I, for one, would like to acknowledge that this is involved an enormous amount of hard work. This rulemaking was a product of the Supreme Court's decision this summer, and here we are on the eve of the beginning of 2008, an election year, and we have been able to sort through one of the most nettlesome questions in this area of the law, the question of what sort of speech this agency can regulate. And we were able to promulgate both a rule and an explanation and justification today in a very short period of time. And I want to express my appreciation for the hard work of the staff and for the commissioners around the table at having to hash through what I thought were difficult and long days, but at the end, productive days. And I want to express my appreciation that we were able to bring this rulemaking to a close before the end of this year. I also want to acknowledge that we received comments that highlighted that while our regulations in themselves do not distinguish among corporations. The ENJ did, and there is a document that was submitted to amend the ENJ to bring it into conformance with the regulations, which seemed appropriate as well. And so with that, hopefully we'll be able to bring this matter to a close, but I did want to express my appreciation and thanks to everybody for their hard work. Commissioner Weintraub?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I also want to thank the staff, in particular Ron Catwan, Peg Pearl, and Tony Buckley, for really exemplary work on this document. It makes our job so easy when we get something from staff that's in such great shape and on a very short turnaround time. I feel compelled to comment because I keep reading things in the paper and on the blogs about how the FEC rules are opening up the gateways for all sorts of corporate and union-funded ads. And I just want to say again, as our staff said, as the chairman said, we are implementing a Supreme Court opinion. We didn't make this stuff up. This agency defended the electioneering communications provisions as written by Congress up to the Supreme Court, I believe on three separate occasions. And we did so despite the fact that, you know, there's a diversity of viewpoint about the subject matter here at the table. But we did that, we fought for it, and ultimately we lost in court. And this is the result. We are, of course, implementing the Supreme Court opinion because they've got more authority than we do. And there's no way that we cannot implement the Supreme Court's guidance. And to our friends out there who say, well, this really isn't as clear as we would like it to be. We would like to have perfectly clear guidance that will tell us exactly what we can and can't do in every single situation. Again, we didn't make up the no other reasonable interpretation test, Justice Roberts did. And it is inherently vaguer than the electioneering communications provisions were before. The advantage of the electioneering communications provisions as they were written is that they were clear. They were simple. Everybody understood them. And that was nice in a lot of ways. Now, a lot of people didn't like them for other reasons, but you couldn't argue about their clarity. And we are, I'm afraid, in a less clear world than we were before as a result of the Supreme Court opinion. Now, obviously, there are countervailing interests, and a lot of people think that, you know, that's okay, but we do get that complaint, and I feel compelled to say that I was perfectly happy with the world before, but given the opinion that we received, we have done our best to provide some guidance and to try and help people understand how we're going to be sorting through these issues going forward. So it may not be perfect, but I think actually this document in particular is a very good job, and I'm proud of it, and I'm proud of the work that the staff did. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Other comments? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would be remiss if I didn't note that there are other alternatives to simply taking a particular Supreme Court opinion rendered in a particular case and making of it a general rule. I will concede that that's the normal practice, but I will note in Lincoln's first inaugural, he argued against that position, noting that if we viewed opinions rendered in particular cases as binding on all other cases for all time, that we will have so far rendered surrendered our rights to self-government to that eminent tribunal. And I have to say that I agree with that assessment. While I'm happier than Commissioner Weintraub with the policy outcome in this particular case, I have to note that I think the idea that the Supreme Court is absolute in the matters of constitutional interpretation is not one I happen to agree with. As a practical matter, I think we need to do something like what we've done. And I also agree with her observation that we are left with a less clear test than we had before, which is a little bit odd in light of some of the rhetoric in the opinion itself. But we were doing this because it was what appears to have been contemplated and directed by the Supreme Court opinion.
Thank you. Other comments? Thoughts, suggestions, motions? Council, anyone? Commissioner Weintraub?
Mr. Chairman, would you like someone to move your amendment?
Being incapable of doing so myself, by the procedural rules of the agency, that would be good.
I heartily agree with your amendment, and I appreciate the work of you and your staff in drafting it. And I appreciate the commenter who pointed it out to us and pointed out that we probably should amend the document in this way. So I will move approval of agenda document. Let me see, I want to get the numbers right here. 07-92 as amended by agenda document 07-92A.
Okay, Commissioner Weintraub has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I wonder if the commissioner would be willing to break this into two motions, which is first to approve the amendment to the document and then move for the entire document.
Sure. I will consider that a friendly amendment.
Okay.
I guess then I will withdraw my motion and instead move to amend agenda document 07-92 as set forth in agenda document 07-92A.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye. Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Other motions? Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, in that case, I will now move approval of agenda document 07-92 as recently amended.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub has so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to agree with what was said earlier. A lot of work went into putting this E&J together, and I agree with 95% of what's in here. And I think my colleagues did a very good job of editing and making comments on how this should look and on the draft that we got up from our Office of General Counsel. And I think the exemption that we laid out that puts into our regulations the test laid out by the Supreme Court is a good one. It's a workable one. It may not always be easy to administer, but it does, I think, a very good job of taking a Supreme Court order and trying to implement it. And I agree with that. As you know, however, from our original vote on the regulation, the one thing I disagree with is the part of the regulation and the part of the E&J that requires that if an ad is an issue ad such that it's not considered electioneering communication, as the Supreme Court laid out in its test, that we are requiring in our regulation that the advocacy groups and other organizations that do the ad still have to report financially. And I disagree with that. And as everyone knows, we've already gotten a lawsuit this week against the Federal Election Commission over the fact that we are still going to require reporting of contributions and payments made for these kind of communications. So for that reason, even though I like all the rest of it, I wanted to explain that I'm going to vote against adaptation of the E&J as I did the original regulation. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. No, and we appreciate that. We've obviously internally had long conversations about the appropriate path to take there, and I think there are reasoned arguments on both sides. And as you indicate, Mr. Bopp has now sued us again, and so those reasoned arguments will present themselves before the Supreme Court, and they will ultimately decide, as so often the case, is that is the body that reaches a resolve as to the scope of the First Amendment protections in this area. But I appreciate your willingness to continue to work and help us get this document out despite those reservations. Other comments, thoughts, suggestions? Okay, very good. All in favor of the motion indicate by saying aye. Aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Aye.
Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1 with Commissioner Von Spakovsky dissenting. Council, thank you very much. The next item on our agenda involves final rules on candidate travel. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a late submitted document.
I'm sorry. No,
And very little is timely today. We were lots of late work on the items that appear on today's agenda.
Mr. Chairman, I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider a memorandum from the General Counsel setting forth draft final rules on campaign travel. It's agenda document 0794.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have Joshua Bloom and Richard Yule from the General Counsel's Office. Counsel, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Agenda document 07-94 is a draft final rule implementing the campaign travel provisions of Section 601 of the Honest Leadership and Open Government Act of 2007, which became effective on September 14th of this year. A draft explanation and justification for this rule will be circulated separately at a later date. The draft final rule implements the travel portions of HLOGA, as it's come to be known, in four ways. First, it amends 11 CFR 100.5 by adding a new definition of leadership PAC, which reflects the language provided in the statute. Second, it revises 11 CFR 100.93 by providing new rules governing the rate of reimbursement that candidates and other campaign travelers must pay providers of non-commercial or government aircraft in order to avoid receiving in-kind contributions. Third, it amends 11 CFR Part 113 by adding new 113.5, which directly implements HLOGA's restrictions on expenditures for non-commercial travel on aircraft. Finally, it makes conforming amendments to the regulations governing publicly funded presidential candidates in light of the revisions to 11 CFR 100.93. We would be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. Again, I would like to highlight the amount of hard work by our counsel and the commissioners. This was as implementing a statute which was effective only 3 months ago. It was effective immediately under the terms of that law, and so we have worked very hard to try and get implementing regulations in place as soon as possible so that individuals covered by the statute can have clear guidance as to how it's going to be interpreted by this agency. Other thoughts and comments on the matter before us? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, I hate to be the one to do this again, but I have to say that I think this is a very good document. Again, all of the commissioners had a great deal of input into drafting this regulation. There was a great deal of back and forth, a great deal of discussion on how to do this. And, you know, when Congress adopted S1, it included a very brief section that it called Restrictions on Use of Campaign Funds for Flights on Non-Commercial Aircraft. While legislative brevity is not to be confused with simplicity, it's dismaying to see such a brief piece of legislation balloon into a lengthy and complex set of implementing regulations, but unfortunately, the rule they set out is very complex, and I think the final product that the Commission has come up with is a good one, because it lays out the rules of how this law is going to work. However, once again, I'm unable to cast my vote in favor of this for one reason. The corporate jet provision of S1 was enacted for a very specific purpose, and that was to combat the perceived problems of members of Congress flying on privately owned jets while paying less than the full charter rate in return. The two leading sponsors of S1 explained in written comments that, quote, in recent years, travel by members of Congress on corporate jets contributed greatly to public concern about inappropriate access and influence of lobbyists on the legislative process. I think this proposed regulation today faithfully implements S1 in a manner that's consistent with the sponsor's understanding of its effect on federal candidates. The problem is the regulations go further and do something that Congress very clearly did not intend. The regulations that we're proposed to adopt today impose the new air travel regime not just on federal candidates, which was the entire reach of the bill, but on everyone else in the political world, including political parties and non-candidate political committees. The scope of S1 could not be clearer. It applies only to, quote, candidates for election and, quote, any authorized committees of such a candidate. Congress could have extended this to political parties and non-candidate connected committees, but they specifically did not do so. Now, despite that very clear statutory language, this regulation would extend this rule to all these people who were not included in the original statute. Not a single one of the commenters who sent us public comments on this embraced that proposal at all. Now, just 4 years ago, before my time on the commission, the FEC adopted a regulation imposing the first-class airfare concept. Now, Congress made very clear its rejection of this regulation for candidates, but it did not do so for other political organizations. And there's absolutely nothing in the public record before us, in the testimony, in the comments, that would support disregarding the plain language of the statute and would give us, I think, the authority to more expansively apply this regulation. For those reasons, while I agree with the way it's laid out the rules, I can't support the regulation itself. Thank you.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This does address, this is a response, these regulations are a response to S1, but it's a longstanding issue here at the Commission, how to value airfare, how to value private air transportation, and it's one that the agency has grappled with on many occasions over the years. The guiding principle is supposed to be fair market value, usual and customary rates, and commissioners have disagreed over the years as to exactly what the appropriate fair market value, usual and customary rate analog would be when somebody gets to hop a ride on a private plane. The last time this came up was, although certainly not the first time at this commission, was I think 2003. And at that time, I voted to that the fair market value of riding on a private plane was chartering a private plane. So I voted for the charter rate before. I lost that vote, and we ended up with the rule that we had before, which Congress took exception to in S1. So I am delighted today to be able to vote again for the charter rate, and this time I anticipate that it will carry the day, since Congress did not give us, in most instances, any choice. But it is clearly within our prerogative to define fair market value for any political travel, and that's what this rule does, and tries to do it in a consistent manner across the board, which I think, in a complicated rule, makes life a little bit simpler.
Thank you. Other thoughts, comments? I mean, I think that the position that Commissioner Von Spakovsky has raised both here today and in our internal discussions is thoughtful and a reasonable one under the statute. I have at the end concluded that I agree with Commissioner Weintraub because what we are in fact doing here is determining what the fair market value is for the use of these corporate jets, and the agency had promulgated a rule itself setting that as the equivalent to the cost of first-class airfare a number of years ago, and the question that we presented in the context of these implementations, the implementing of the statute, was whether that was, in fact, whether the record reflected that, in fact, was a fair measure of fair market value. And we got no submissions that provided anything in the form of an argument that the cost of a first-class airfare ticket was a fair measure of the fair market value of the use of a corporate jet. Nor, looking back at the explanation and justification for the original reg, was there much in the way of evidence that would support setting first-class airfare as the fair market value for the use of these jets. It was administratively convenient in that it was reasonably easy to discern what a first-class airfare ticket was, but it did not, I think, fairly measure the value that was being provided in that context. So I, at the end, support adopting a regulation that uses what I think is a better measure of the value of the service being provided in this particular context. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with much of what the Chairman said, and I just want to make a couple of notes. First, I certainly agree that Commissioner Von Spakovsky's position is a reasonable and appropriate one to take. Like Commissioner Weintraub, I was here 4 years ago. I did vote for the first class reimbursement rate at that time. However, I did so for essentially the same reason I'm voting for this regulation today, which is for the purpose of both simplicity and fairness. And actually, sometimes being fair and being simple are great tension.
Conflict.
and here I believe that they are not. Prior to 4 years ago, we had a two-tier rate structure. Candidates could get the first-class rate, and other committees could not get the first-class rate. And, for instance, that led to the oddity that not only did political parties not get the first-class rate, but leadership PACs didn't get the first-class rate. And so we got into a discussion, and it certainly didn't make any sense to me to have two different sets of reimbursement costs depending on the identity of the political committee. And I thought it was simple. And Commissioner Von Spakovsky talked about complexity and complexity being a problem. I very much agree. This is a very complex law, too complex. And when we have an opportunity to make it simpler, I think there's a strong reason to do so. Congress, for whatever reasons, has decided they don't want members flying and paying at the first-class rate, and that's fine. And we could, I certainly concede, have revised the regulation and gone back to a two-tier rate structure, which would be the opposite of what we had prior to 4 years ago. However, I don't think that would have made any particular sense. In other words, I don't see any public policy reason or any rationale underlying in the Act for why that would be. And in fact, I agree with my colleagues that the general rule in the Act is fair market value, and that generally speaking, charter and first class are not the same thing. And so it's clear that we have the authority to change the reg that we, after all, changed 4 years ago and wrote some years before that. And I believe that we come out with a more simple and therefore better result by applying the same rate to every type of committee.
Other thoughts, comments? Commissioner Walther.
Well, since everybody made a comment, you made the comment one time, everybody spoke but one. But I would just sort of echo the chairman that I think what we really are getting here is some parity and some simplicity that has been missing, and also a recognition that the charter rate is a fair rate and one that, that makes sense, I think, to just apply across the board.
Other thoughts? Vice Chairman Mason.
I move approval of the draft final rules as set forth in Agenda Document 0794.
Okay, the Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed?
Nay.
Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1 with Commissioner Von Spakovsky voting against. Council, thank you very much. The next item on our agenda is Draft Advisory Opinion 2000-34 involving Representative Jesse L. Jackson, Jr. Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider a memorandum containing this draft advisory opinion, Agenda Document 0793.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have Joshua Bloom and Ron Catwan from the General Counsel's Office. Counsel, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Jesse Jackson, Jr. of the 2nd Congressional District of Illinois requested the advisory opinion before you in Agenda Document Number 07-93. The request seeks confirmation that Representative Jackson may appear on a billboard located in Representative Jackson's district with a candidate for local office in order to endorse that candidate in advance of a primary election in which both Representative Jackson and the local candidate will appear on the ballot. The local candidate's campaign organization would pay for the billboard with funds that were raised in accordance with Illinois law, but that do not necessarily comply with the amount limitations and source prohibitions of the Act. The draft concludes that, based on the evidence provided, Representative Jackson may appear on the billboard despite its being financed with non-federal funds because the billboard is not a coordinated communication under Section 109.21 of the Commission's regulations and hence is not an in-kind contribution to Representative Jackson. Specifically, the draft determines that the billboard is not a coordinated communication because it satisfies an exemption from the definition of coordinated communication that applies to public communications in which federal candidates endorse other candidates unless the communications promote, support, attack, or oppose the endorsing federal candidate or another candidate who seeks election to the same office as the endorsing candidate. We received no comments on the draft, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Very good. I will note from the expression on some of the people in the audience, yes, there is roofing going on above your heads. So that is the hammering sound above. Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Mr. Chairman, this draft opinion from the Office of General Counsel is a very straightforward application of the candidate endorsement exception in our coordinated regulation, so I'm happy to move that we adopt it, and that's agenda document 07-93.
Very good. Commissioner Von Spakovsky is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Council, thank you. The next item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-31 involving the John Edwards for President campaign. And Mr. Vice Chairman, we have a late submitted document on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider two memoranda setting forth alternative drafts of advisory opinion 2007-31, agenda document 0789 and 0789A.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have Eric Hallstrom and Amy Rothstein from the General Counsel's Office. Counsel, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The draft of advisory opinion 2007-31 set forth in agenda document 07-89 responds to a request from the Principal Campaign Committee for John Edwards for President. The request asks whether under the Matching Payment Act, the committee may submit for matching funds earmarked contributions that were forwarded to the committee by checks drawn on ACT Blue's account. ACT Blue is a non-connected political committee registered with the commission. The draft concludes that the earmarked contributions that ACT Blue forwards to the committee by check drawn on ACT Blue's account are not matchable because they fall within the category of contributions that are specifically within the exclusion or that the Matching Payment Act and commission regulations specifically exclude from the definition of qualifying for matching funds. The commission received a large number of comments, including comments from the requester, and I would be pleased to try to address any questions the commission might have.
Thank you. Comments or discussion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think in some ways this was a difficult request for a lot of us because the policy arguments are pretty compelling here. And hundreds of commenters, not our usual commenters, but the kind of people who comment when Daily Coast puts something up on his website, and a lot of people who are steered to make comments from the Edwards website as well, ordinary citizens contacted us by email and said, why shouldn't my contribution be matched? I made a contribution to John Edwards. I happened to go through ACT Blue, but why should my contribution be treated differently than other folks' contributions who went through the Edwards website directly? And in fact, for at least a period of time, people who went to the website of the Edwards campaign directly were routed to ACT Blue in order to make contributions. A lot of people pointed out that in an age of internet fraud, they felt safe using the ACT Blue website, and that way they didn't have to worry about whether this was johnedwards.com or johnedwards.net, or was it a fraudulent website? And we have seen that in the political arena. We've seen folks try and set up fraudulent campaign websites for the purpose of grabbing people's campaign, their credit card information, and defrauding them that way. And people said, well, we feel safe using ACT Blue. It's just like PayPal. And indeed, we do recognize PayPal and match contributions that are made through PayPal. And for the people who are making these contributions, it felt an awful lot like PayPal. They didn't know the difference. A lot of people didn't seem to realize that ACT Blue was a political committee at all, which it is. That's not, some people said, don't make ACT Blue a political committee. That's not what we're deciding here. ACT Blue already is a political committee. They voluntarily registered as one. But people don't think of it in the same way as a political committee. And encouraging small donors and encouraging the use of the presidential funding system at all are both goals of the Act that I personally am very supportive of. Now, when I first looked at our law and regulations, I have to admit, I felt that my hands were tied by the regulations that we have on the books, which were written 30 years ago and clearly did not anticipate an entity such as ACT Blue, because The internet didn't exist back then. But I felt that the words of the regulation really kind of tied my hands. But I was really moved by the volume of the comments and by the arguments that people made. Comments by people like Clark Burnett, who sent us an email saying, "Don't kill off one of the few ways average Joes like me have a voice in the process, in the political process." And I really don't want to do that. So I went back and looked at the regulation again and found a slight ambiguity in there, a way that I thought we could look at the law and the regs and say, well, maybe if it is a little ambiguous because they use the term committee, they don't use the term political committee in the regs, maybe that gives us an opening to take a look at the policy considerations and come to a different conclusion here. And I think another way that we could look at this is that particular regulation is supposed to be implementing a section of the statute that talks about transfer of funds from one political committee to another. And as the Edwards campaign pointed out to us, and they're right, transfer is a term of art under the Federal Election Campaign Act, and it refers to money that's moved from one political committee to another affiliated political committee. If John Edwards wanted to move money from his Senate campaign to his presidential campaign, that would be a transfer. And that's not what we're looking at here. So I have proposed an alternative, and I don't know whether it will get any support, but I think that in any event, this request points out to us that, as inevitably happens when some of our regulations sit on the books for 30 years, we need to take another look at this regulation and need to revamp it for the future, because it clearly was not intended to cover this situation.
Thank you. Other thoughts or comments? I mean, I can chime in. I like Commissioner Weintraub, have some sympathy for the situation, or the concerns raised by the commenters, and we got many, because I think that the one of the things that is there's not enough of in American politics right now is the active participation of individuals of modest means. And we have done a number of things while I've been here, and the agency did a number of things before I arrived, to try and facilitate the ability of individuals to operate in the political system despite a large and complex regulatory regime. One of the prices of a large and complex regulatory regime is that it prohibits activity that people would otherwise like to engage in, and sometimes there are people that we like and would like to have active, but the law does not permit it. And so I approach this again with some sympathy towards the participants in this. That said, I think I diverge from Commissioner Weintraub somewhat in that I think the statute and the regulation do directly address this particular situation, and I am less convinced that the regulations were not mindful of something very similar to Act Blue. While obviously Act Blue was not in the minds of the Commission 30 years ago when they did this, it does seem the way the regulation was crafted that they were mindful of political committees collecting contributions from individuals and forwarding them on, and that seems to be what's going on here. And so I have somewhat more difficulty deciding that the regulations that are on the books right now are inapplicable. Maybe the concerns that caused the Commission to create those regulations should be reconsidered and we should change them, but I'm a little less persuaded that they simply were designed for a problem utterly unlike the one we're looking at today. The other thing that I am mindful of is that an organization like organizations could do things that are like this. Our regulations do not prohibit this kind of activity done differently. Act Blue could be a vendor, and the Edwards Committee argues that they are like vendors, but in several crucial ways they are not. And it were Act Blue to be a vendor, they could do this, but they're not trying to be a vendor, they're trying to be something else. Similarly, people, you know, we've been, people could, you know, contribute directly to the Edwards campaign over the internet, and while there is a risk of some confusion as to who is who out there, I'm not sure having political committees serve as the collection system for those for the candidates necessarily takes us very far away from that concern. I think that there's a not unreasonable argument raised by the Edwards Committee that these are transfers and that, or that these are not transfers as that term is defined. Although I think that the term is used somewhat more broadly in some other contexts, and certainly the movement of funds from the committee to Edwards in many ways looks very much like what our regulations are prescribing in this context. So that was the reason why I initially supported the staff draft before it went out on blue, and why I'm finding it somewhat hard to construe an alternative approach as a better, although I do have, at the end of the day, some misgivings that the consequence is that the people who wanted to participate in this way, who are not, forming the cornerstone of the risks of corruption that guided the crafting of the statute, will be thwarted or hindered in some way in their ability to do so. Other thoughts or comments? Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I struggled with this one because my natural inclination is, as others, and that's to make it as easy as possible for people to participate and to easily get online and feel safe, as Commissioner Weintraub said, about this money's going to go exactly where I want it to go. And so I struggled with how we could make it work, but given our current regulation, we'd have to pretty much override our regulation here with an advisory opinion, and that isn't the way I think we ought to proceed. But I think if we were drafting, my guess is if we were drafting another regulation now, we would figure out a way to make it work with the electronic means that we are now becoming familiar with using to an increasing degree. So I reluctantly find myself in a position of finding that in this particular case, the request should not be granted under our current law. But I want to give admiration to Commissioner Weintraub for her effort, because I do think that's probably the best argument that could be made, and it's just, to me, I'm not able to be persuaded today.
Other thoughts? Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
I have to agree with the chairman and Commissioner Walther. One of the comments I saw on the Daily Cuss was that the OGC draft was too literal an interpretation of the statute. Well, that's exactly the problem. The statute is perfectly clear on this issue. And I completely agree. The statute, when it was written, was not written with the situation in mind, because at the time this was written, the internet didn't exist, and this kind of contribution method was not around. And I think when a statute is ambiguous or unclear, then we do have room, as the agency given the authority by Congress to interpret it, to come up with regulations and interpretations that, for example, and we've been very good about this, that allows for changes in technology. And we have done that when we've been able to do it. And I think everybody here agrees with that. But when the statute is absolutely clear, an agency does not have the ability to ignore the statute or override it. And the statute says, quote, funds received by a political committee which are transferred to that committee from another committee are not matchable. And ActBlue is a registered political committee with us. And while I give you kudos, Commissioner Weintraub, on your creativeness, I think your alternate draft was quite a stretch. I don't like the result here. I think we should encourage this kind of innovation in the political process. But this is one of those unfortunate situations where the agency doesn't have the authority to change this. Congress has the ability to change the statute if they want to allow this. But the statute and our regulation is so clear that I just don't see a way of doing anything other than adopting the draft that the General Counsel has provided to us.
Okay. Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree with what Commissioner Von Spakovsky just said. I just want to make a
couple of other brief notes, but just to summarize that our ability to provide flexibility is constrained by the statute. And I think most of the time we are better served by a literal reading than by a non-literal reading of the statute as well. I want to note one thing that is apparent to me but hasn't been discussed and is also material to how far we go, and that is that, as I understand it, because of some prior advisory opinions that we had issued, the Edwards campaign was told during the time they were doing this that contributions received through Act Blue were not matchable. Is that correct?
That is our understanding, yes.
And who told them that?
How did we find the general
counsel? Act Blue advised them of that. Is that correct?
That's correct.
All right. So they were told, and this went on for several months, and despite having been advised about it, they went ahead with that activity, advised that it wasn't matchable, they went ahead with that activity. Now, I take it what was going on at the time is that the Edwards campaign thought they wouldn't be applying for matching funds, and so it wouldn't matter. So I can understand why they now come back. But I just want to note that in terms of people's expectations, that at least in terms of the Edwards campaign, they were told what Act Blue believed the consequence to be at the time. The second thing I want to note is I agree with what I believe all of my colleagues have said about promoting flexibility and promoting small donors, but I just want to raise one caution about the issue of political committees bundling money to other political committees. When we look at Act Blue, it looks fine because Act Blue supports any Democrat, and nobody really cares. I mean, Republicans want to support Republicans and Democrats, but Act Blue apparently does not have any agenda other than the broadest possible agenda. However, if we were to approve this activity as to Act Blue, there would be nothing stopping a political committee that had a far narrower and perhaps far more controversial agenda from doing the same thing. One of my former colleagues used to posit activity by the Osama bin Laden Missile Corporation, which, if it existed, would be eligible to have a PAC for its American employees, and they could bundle contributions to the candidate of their choice. Or it might be Enron, to choose perhaps a more likely and recent activity. And if the Enron Corporation, if they were to revive PAC, were to bundle a whole lot of money and give it to particular candidates, people might be a little bit concerned. Frankly, I would think that was okay, all right? But my point is that the policy implications of that sort of activity would be very different than from activity with a group such as Act Blue. And so I think we need to be careful about the policy implications when we take this one political committee that everybody views as kind of an apple pie type of committee and craft a rule which would then be used by other committees. And so while I agree that it would be a good thing to provide even more opportunities, and the chairman's right that the commission has been trying to do this progressively over the years, for small donors to make contributions to political committees and for them to be matched if the candidates are in the public funding program, I don't think that that policy goal should simply knock down every other concern out there in the statute. And I think that's just the one issue that if we move forward in that policy area in a regulation or if Congress does by legislation, we would need to think about the implications of other types of political committees engaging in this activity.
No, I think that's very helpful, and it certainly was one of the things that I thought about, and the example I used actually was the tobacco industry, which is a controversial industry and one that is politically active and has political action committees, and they presumably could also, were this to be the rule, ask individuals to make contributions to candidates, collect those together, and deliver a very large check far above the contribution limits to the candidate, reflecting the contributions of all those individual contributors. And so that's sort of why I guess these things get sorted out in regulations, and that may in fact have been part of the although I suspect other things were going on that underlay some of the regulatory work in this area as well. But those are certainly well worth thinking through. So often it's the consequences and other circumstances of the conclusions we reach in advisory opinions that occupy much of the time as we sort of sort through what the right answer is. Vice Chairman Mason.
If there aren't other statements, I'd be happy to move approval of draft advisory opinion 2007-31 as set forth in agenda document 0789.
Very good. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Discussion on the motion? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, I won't insist on a vote on my motion because I can see it wouldn't do very well on my draft. I do want to point out that, A, it's limited to non-connected committees acting merely as conduits, and B, that political committees do bundle contributions for political candidates all the time, and there's nothing wrong with it. It's perfectly legal. You know, it happens, and including some with a particular agenda. Emily's list springs to mind. They're pretty successful at it. Mm-hmm. So that's not really what we're talking about here. We're talking about whether in the unusual circumstance, once every 4 years, of bundling contributions to presidential candidates, are those small donations that are, in this case, routed merely as a conduit through another committee, are they going to be matchable? That's really the only question that's on the table. But I respect my colleague's reading of the regulation, which was, you know, my initial reading of the regulation as well. I thought there was a little bit more room for maneuverability in there than my colleagues do, but I respect their judgment on that. I'll vote against the motion.
Other discussion? Okay. All in favor, indicate by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Those opposed?
No.
Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-1 with Commissioner Weintraub dissenting. Counsel, thank you very much. The next item on our agenda involves Draft Advisory Opinion 2007-27. We have alternative drafts. Unfortunately, there is no late submitted document here, so we will turn to S.S. Farah and Amy Rothstein from the General Counsel's Office. Counsel, please proceed at your convenience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good afternoon, Commissioners. The agenda document before you is two alternative draft advisory opinions in response to request from Act Blue. Act Blue is a non-connected political committee and plans to solicit, receive, and forward contributions designated for specific separate segregated funds under two proposed fundraising programs. Under Program 1, Act Blue will solicit the general public for contributions to SSFs, and under Program 2, Act Blue will solicit the restricted classes of SSFs connected organizations for contributions to those SSFs. Draft A concludes that both Program 1 and Program 2 are permissible, but Act Blue must implement and maintain effective policies to ensure the independence of its solicitations under Program 1 if it includes the same SSF in both programs. Draft B concludes that Program 1 is impermissible and that Program 2 is permissible, but only to the extent that the costs associated with Act Blue's activities under Program 2 do not result in prohibitive, excessive, in-kind contributions. We received several comments on the drafts, one of which is from the requesters. I'll be happy to answer any questions you may have. Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. Comments? Discussion? Motions? Someone must have some thoughts.
Maybe if that's all right.
Mr. Chairman, we'd had some informal discussions beforehand about where four votes may lie on this, and I think that really is the question before us. Policy-wise, I think it would be appropriate to allow both programs, and I did note to my colleagues in the counsel's office that we had a somewhat similar request from the National Restaurant Association a few months ago, which I voted to approve, but which the commission as a whole did not vote to approve, and I viewed this as somewhat similar to that. In that case, it was the SSF that was proposing to solicit on behalf of another committee. Here it's another committee proposing to solicit on behalf of the SSF. I did not see a substantial difference in that. And so I would be willing to vote to support a draft that that approved both programs. I'd also note that I'm skeptical even about the coordination issue or the coordination condition or the firewall condition that's placed in here, in part because our coordination regulations go to communications most specifically, and also because it's it appears to me that there wouldn't be any danger in the SSF, in essence, advising Act Blue about how to solicit other people. I agree that if they asked Act Blue to do it, that Act Blue solicitation would be an in-kind contribution. But I don't. But given that requirement condition, if that were met, I wouldn't see any need to have different people within Act Blue working on the two programs.
Okay, thank you. Other thoughts? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was tired from so much talking before. I thought I'd sit back, but okay. I support Draft B. I think that this is, I guess, in a sort of a flip side of things that weren't anticipated in the internet age. When Congress created PACs as a separate segregated funds as a legal entity and said they can be subsidized in their administrative costs by a connected organization that otherwise would not be able to subsidize the operations of a political committee, they made a trade-off there. They said, yes, the corporation, the labor union can subsidize the operations, can pay for the administrative costs, but then you have to limit the solicitations to your restricted class of executives and members. I don't think anybody anticipated that while it's not prohibited for outsiders to contribute to these SSFs, doesn't now happen all that often, I think, I don't think anybody ever anticipated a situation where there would be wide-scale solicitations of everybody in America through the internet to an SSF that has its operations in part subsidized by an impermissible source. So I think, you know, people might want to think hard about whether that makes sense and whether I think people in Congress might want to think about that, whether that fits in with the whole regulatory regime to enable someone to solicit on the internet broadly for an SSF. And I think in my view, it's really not in sync with what Congress had in mind. So I think Draft B, which says yes, you can solicit the restricted class, but no, you can't solicit all of America, is more closely in sync with the regime that Congress had in mind.
Other thoughts, Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm sure Commissioner Weintraub, that pounding on the roof was not a comment on what you were saying.
Always worried when the pounding comes from above.
I agree with the Vice Chairman in that this request from Act Blue, to me, from a legal substantive standpoint, is almost the same as an advisory opinion request we received last year in the National Restaurant Association. And in that one, I, as the Vice Chairman, supported a draft response that would have allowed them to engage in this behavior. That lost. For that reason, I can't vote to adopt Draft A because I think it would be fundamentally unfair for us last year to have told the National Restaurant Association that they can't engage in this behavior and then yet today vote to tell Act Blue that they can engage in this behavior. And I don't think as a matter of fundamental fairness and equity that we can do that. So, I mean, I'm not prepared to support Draft A for that particular reason.
Good. Other thoughts, suggestions? Commissioner Walther?
I'll be supporting Draft B as well for the reason stated. The concern I had regarding Draft A is the closeness involved just seems to me to be, as Commissioner Weintraub said, to be beyond the pale of what was envisioned when the statute was adopted. And at least with Act B, we allow them to work with the class, but also the in-kind contribution, I think, is limited to $5,000, and I could certainly live with that. So I'm inclined to support Draft B.
Okay.
And I understood you had some reservations about Draft B. If you have, let's interested to hear your comments. We have not had time to talk about that.
Yeah, I'm unhappy with everything, but that's the state I find myself in life right now. So.
Sorry to open up the question.
But and as I've expressed individually to some of the commissioners, and will happily do so here publicly. I mean, I think that there are parallels or similarities with the situation we faced with the Restaurant Association, and I had opposed their going forward with their plan then, and I think that similarly would oppose Act Blue going forward with a similar plan here. So I am unable to support Draft A. I think in part. For the reasons that are in some way similar to what the reasons I expressed in the Restaurant Association and my sense of Commissioner Weintraub, I think, put it reasonably, which is that, you know, what the nature and source of the statutory their structure here. Draft B, comes closer to, I think, a reasonable reading of the law as I see it. There are elements I have some misgivings about, but if that were the one, that we may end up deadlocked as we did in the Restaurant Association if that were, possible that four commissioners supported Draft B, I would join to make a fourth so that we would be able to issue a decision in this and overlook whatever misgivings I might have about some of the more minor twists and turns to it. But I am somewhat unclear whether Commissioner von Spakovsky's decision to vote against Draft A leaves him wanting to support B, or whether we simply are at a point of unable to find four commissioners for either version.
Well, Mr. Chairman, my question is, what changes would you like to see in Draft B? Because I don't think I've
heard it. We got a long day ahead of us. I would suggest for the desire, the economy and need to sort through both this agenda, and for those of you who are members of the public, we move to executive session after this, and so this is only the precursor to another set of discussions we're going to have a little later on. So I would leave my comments where they are. Commissioner Weintraub.
Well, unless the Vice Chairman wants a vote on Draft A, I'll move Draft B.
Vice Chairman Mason.
Mr. Chairman, I would be willing to vote for Draft B in order to allow them to do half of what I think they ought to be able to do. And if that, through some combination, will create four votes, I'm willing to do that. If I'm going to do that, I'm going to want to vote on Draft A. If not, I don't need it. You know, I just want sort of the record to be clear what my preference would have been if my vote is necessary to secure adoption of Draft B.
Yeah, in that light, I mean, there have been a number of points. You know, it's funny. I tell people sometimes that this is an agency where bipartisanship works, where people are forced for the agency to function across party lines. And one of the ways in which that, and they look at me like I'm a crazy person, right? So, but it's true because I live it, right? And one of the reasons why that's been true while I've been here is that people. The commissioners have been willing to accept something that is reasonable but is not ideal in their mind, and I am willing to do that here. I think that in part because there's a sense that there is that, you know, we don't get to, you know, have the world look exactly the way we'd like it to look, and there is a need to compromise to achieve the effective functioning of this agency. And so if my vote is necessary, important to get a fourth vote to provide advice and approve at least what is in B, then I will do that. And I think that so as a consequence, I think it would be valuable for you to make a motion as to A, so that at least we can have a record vote on that. And I think that it will make clear that there is this latent question, that there are a number of commissioners at the agency who believe the law should be more expansive than others, and that this is a matter we will probably be revisiting, the agency will be revisiting in the future as well. So that may be the most orderly way to proceed. Mr. Vice Chairman?
I move approval of Draft A.
Okay. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed?
Nay.
Madam, you're abstaining. Commissioner Vonskovsky will abstain. Okay, Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman Vice Chairman's motion fails with one vote in favor, his own, three votes in opposition, myself, Commissioner Weintraub, and Commissioner Walther, and Commissioner Vonskovsky abstaining. Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move draft B.
Okay. Commissioner Weintraub has so moved. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. And so that brings this matter to a close. Council, thank you for your assistance. The next item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-28. We again have alternative drafts and a late submitted document.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move approval, suspension of our rules concerning the timely submission of documents so that we may consider a memorandum setting forth draft advisory opinion 2007-28 or alternative drafts. It's agenda document 0791.
Okay. The Vice Chairman is so moved. Discussion on the motion. Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. We have here, somewhat surprisingly, Adam Schwartz from the General Counsel's Office and Ron Catlin. And for those of you who are not insiders, Mr. Schwartz usually presents himself in the context of enforcement actions. He is, in fact, one of our lead enforcement attorneys, and we appreciate his willingness to step in and help out on this advisory opinion.
It was Counsel? A pleasure to do so. Good afternoon, Commissioners. Representatives Kevin McCarthy and Devin Nunez requested the advisory opinion before you in agenda document 0791. The requesters seek permission to raise funds on behalf of a ballot initiative committee formed to support the qualification and passage of a redistricting ballot initiative appearing on either the California statewide primary or general election ballot. The Office of General Counsel prepared two alternative draft advisory opinions. Draft A concludes that Representatives McCarthy and Nunez may, subject to the conditions set forth in 2 U.S.C. 441 IE4, raise funds beyond federal limits for redistricting ballot initiative committees that are neither directly nor indirectly established, financed, maintained, or controlled by, or acting on behalf of, either office holder, and or organizations described in Section 501C and exempt from taxation under Section 501A of the Internal Revenue Code. Although Representatives McCarthy and Nunez are federal office holders, and thus subject to the general prohibition against raising funds outside the Act's contribution limits and source prohibitions in connection with an election for federal or non-federal office, including funds for any federal election activity, 2 U.S.C. 441 IE4 A and B provide specific exemptions that would permit Representatives McCarthy and Nunez to make certain solicitations on behalf of 501C tax-exempt organizations. Draft B concludes that Representatives McCarthy and Nunez may freely raise funds for ballot initiative committees not established, financed, maintained, or controlled by either office holder for the purpose of supporting the qualification and passage of a redistricting ballot initiative because the activity is not in connection with an election for purposes of Section 441 IE. Draft B bases this conclusion on the statutory and regulatory definitions of the term election, which define election in terms of contests for public office and do not reference ballot initiatives or referenda. Thus, 2 U.S.C. 441 IE 1 A and B would not restrict Representatives McCarthy and Nunez from raising non-federal funds on behalf of a redistricting ballot initiative committee not established, financed, maintained, or controlled by either one of them. We have received one comment on the drafts, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Discussion? Comments? Commissioner Weintraub.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is not the first time that we've had to grapple with ballot initiative committees and whether they were contemplated by Congress at all, and if so, when they passed BCRA, what they intended to do about them, and whether they meant to limit federal office holders in their from soliciting funds on behalf of ballot initiative committees, which are state entities, and sometimes get involved in federal election activities in that they do get out the vote activities, they might do voter registration. They do the sort of things that federal officials are normally not allowed under BCRA to solicit soft money to do. Now, we were faced with this question in the ballot initiative committees in the Berman Doolittle AO, which we resolved through sort of an odd technique of giving a very short answer, and then everybody wrote separate opinions as to how they got there, and perhaps that's where we'll end up today. I had hoped early on that we might be able to just kind of hop over that difficult question of whether ballot initiative, fundraising for ballot initiative committees are in connection with an election or not in connection with an election, because I had a feeling we were going to have a hard time getting to a consensus on that. But I've been convinced after discussions with my, and that was what motivated draft A, I've been convinced after reviewing the comments and discussions with my colleagues that we probably can't avoid the question. And for me, I think that they are in connection with an election. In Berman Doolittle, we had the fortunate but unusual circumstance that the ballot initiative was on the ballot on a day when there were no candidates on the ballot. And certainly I understand the argument that we have always defined election as a candidate election, but when people go to the polls on election day and they get out their ballot and it's got initiatives and it's got their candidates all on the same thing, it's really all part of the same election. And if people are raising funds for helping to get people to the polls for doing federal election activity in connection with what happens on that election day, I think that is in connection with an election. And I think at first I thought that the general solicitation exception of 441 IE 4A applied, but I've been convinced by the comments that under our regulations that it doesn't. However, I do think that the exception in 441 IE 4B great citation, does apply, which permits federal candidates and office holders to make a solicitation explicitly to obtain funds for carrying out Class 1 and Class 2 federal election activities, or for an entity whose principal purpose is to conduct such activities if the solicitation is made only to individuals and the amount solicited from any individual during any calendar year does not exceed $20,000. That pretty plainly says and shows that Congress anticipated that they would be fundraising for federal election activities for 501Cs that do federal election activities subject to these limits. So I can get there, which is actually a fair amount of leeway for the candidates. They can raise up to $20,000 from individuals, which is a lot more than one could normally raise under the federal limits. But I don't think that I can get any further than that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other comments, questions, thoughts, suggestions? Vice Chairman Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have previously taken the position and still do that a referendum or ballot initiative is not an election. And as I laid out in a couple of opinions previous, the Commission's rules refer to elections as the process of electing candidates. Candidates aren't at issue in ballot initiatives and referenda, and indeed the Supreme Court in the Bilotti decision elsewhere has laid out different standards for treatment of referenda and candidate elections. And for that reason, I would be willing to answer yes, that the candidates involved here may raise funds for this ballot committee. However, as we have done before, I would be willing to support an opinion that was more limited than either of the ones we have before us, which simply said that you may raise this money from individuals in amounts of no more than $20,000 and then refer to separate statements for the explanation, which is essentially the compromise we came to the last time we had a similar proposal before us.
Okay. Very good. Other thoughts? I mean, I share Commissioner Weintraub's views on this, and I think that the Vice Chairman has set forth a means by which we could provide a clear answer and maintain somewhat different legal analyses. But other commissioners' thoughts on this? Commissioner Von Spakovsky?
Well, I wasn't here when the Berman Doolittle AO was issued. which was a very similar issue. But if I'd been here, I would have joined the concurring opinions of that time Vice Chairman to Honor Commissioner Mason, which said that the plain meaning of the statute is that the soft money ban applies to federal and non-federal elections for public office. It doesn't apply to non-candidate elections. I support draft B. And my suggestion would be, since I think we otherwise can't get an agreement on either draft A or draft B, is that we do provide an answer, but a short answer, very similar to what was provided in the Berman-Doolittle, and that we then write concurring opinions on the legal analysis that each of us has brought. But I do not think that the opinion, I don't think the opinion should say, and that is the primary opinion, not the concurring opinion of the commissioners. I don't think the primary opinion should put a $20,000 limit in, and I think it should say that under the specific facts that have been provided in the request, you know, the commission's concluded that you can engage in this activity, but the commissioners have differing opinions on what the legal analysis is provides the reason you can do it, and they have different opinions on whether it's unlimited or whether it's limited to $20,000, and you and they have to govern themselves accordingly.
Commissioner Weintraub?
I can't support an opinion that says, you know, yes, you can do this, and different commissioners have different views as to how much, because I think if we just say, yes, you can do this, that gives them a lot more running room than I would be. Because I don't think, yes, you can do this. I think, in general, you can only do this up to $20,000 and from individuals. I don't think, as a general rule, they can do this. They can only do it subject to that exception. And I think it would be useful. I understand that there are at least two commissioners who would go further than that and would say, you can do whatever you want. But there isn't consensus for that. And I think it would be useful to the requester to get a clear answer from the commission that says, everybody agrees you can do this up to $20,000 from individuals, and then there would be concurring statements from some that said, we think you could do even more than that. But I think that would provide clearer guidance to the requester and would be something I could approve.
Other thoughts, suggestions? Commissioner Walther?
So that's an arrest, and I agree that I could support the $20,000 limitation as well.
Okay.
Without having to reach, you know, an opinion today on the issue of where we got there.
Okay. Exactly. Vice Chairman Mason?
I just wanted to check with the Office of General Counsel if they feel like, looking at the Berman-Doolittle precedent and our discussion, you could draft an opinion that simply said the commission agrees that you can do this by individuals and up to $20,000, and referring them to concurring opinions for the legal analysis.
Counsel?
The Berman-Doolittle advisory opinion literally had one sentence of analysis, which simply said that in that instance you could proceed and you were not restricted. So I think we'll just essentially copy that and accept, come out to the different result, and then refer them to the exemption in 300.65 1B, I believe it is, which allows the $20,000 from individuals.
Well, I think that may be what we want to avoid. I think if the opinion simply states the result and refers to the concurring opinions for the rationale, it would be preferable, because we're trying to get over the issue of whether it is in connection with an election in the first place.
When I first arrived here, my staff and I toyed around with the possibility that the agency should begin answering advisory opinion requests with simply the word yes or no. And this is maybe this one we could answer just by saying maybe or kinda. And then refer to the
this much.
I mean, my sense is that there's clarity that this activity is that to the degree that they raise money from individuals in sums, you know, up to $20,000, that there is no ambiguity that they are permitted to do that by law. and that there is not a consensus upon whether they can do raise sums above that from individuals.
That's correct, and that's what I'm trying to reach for.
And I guess the question is, can that is this discussion sufficiently clear that were we the commission to instruct staff to prepare such a response that they believe that they have the guidance now to line those words up in rows that say that?
I think based on the last comments, we do.
Okay, very good.
And as to Commissioner Von Spakovsky, I hope he'll join in this in approving this motion. I don't think the result really would be any different either way. If we provided a more general answer, I think my colleagues that are to my right are correct that this would easily be interpreted as saying you could ask for corporate money and you could ask for $100,000 and so on like that. But in looking at the underlying legal analysis, they would see there was some risk if they did that because some whereas if we do it this way, they'll get the assurance that they can do it, you know, a fairly substantial amount of fundraising. In fact, practically a very large amount of fundraising. And they would also see that there's a legal analysis out there that if they chose to raise money in even larger sums and from other sources, they wouldn't have the protection of an advisory opinion, but that there would not be a firm resolution either way as to what the result of that activity would be.
Good. Time for motion.
Mr. Chairman, I move to instruct the staff to draft a brief advisory opinion as discussed, and commissioners will issue concurring statements.
Very good. The vice chairman is so moved. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the vice chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Council, thank you very much. The next item on our agenda involves draft advisory opinion 2007-25, Holland & Knight LLP. We have both Albert Kiss and Ron Catwan from the General Counsel's Office.
Mr. Chairman?
Mr. Vice Chairman.
I don't want to cut off Mr. Kiss's opportunity, but as I understand it, we have no further submissions from the requester here.
That's correct, Mr. Vice Chairman.
Okay. As I recall, Mr. Chairman, we were 3-2 or something
correct.
Like that last week, and I had laid out some concerns that I had that the requester might be in some legal jeopardy, and pointedly said to them that the effect of a delay would be to allow them to submit any ex parte communication that would suggest a possible resolution. I didn't have a perfect one then. I haven't had one since. They haven't cared to speak, and so my suggestion would be to inform the requester that the commission was unable to render an opinion. I'd be happy to so move.
Okay. It seems like a reasonable outcome to me. I look around to see whether other commissioners seem to think that would be a reasonable way to proceed. Okay. Mr. Vice Chairman, please.
So moved, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Vice Chairman is so moved. Any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, the Vice Chairman's motion has been adopted by a vote of 5-0. Council, thank you. The second to last item on our agenda, the management administrative matters lurk at the end, is election of officers. And this is the last public meeting of 2007, and after this we're going to have our last executive session of the year. And so by the end of the day, I will have chaired my last meeting here at the FEC. And so while I still control the gavel, I am going to take the liberty of speaking for a few moments about this last year. Because I would like to thank the people at this table especially. We have worked very, very hard this year, and really over the past 2 years, to improve the operations of this agency. We do not have very much money to spend here. We have roughly $60 million a year, and there are very few people in this building to help us achieve our mission. We have about 375 full-time employees. And yet, for want of a better term, we are regulating an industry that raises and spends more than $4 billion in election cycle. Our last presidential election, the candidates and parties spent about $1 billion. They are going to spend dramatically more. And so there are, we have very limited resources to perform the mission we have been assigned by Congress. As a number of people who've been who spent a lot of time with me know, last year I used to joke that aircraft carriers are bigger than the FEC. Until at some point somebody told me that, in fact, aircraft carriers are dramatically larger. I think it's by a magnitude of 15 times the size of the FEC, and that, in fact, we were only the size of a cruiser, which I actually didn't think was that bad for a little while. Cruiser sounds kind of impressive until I figured out that the Navy has over 22 of them, and they cost about $1 billion each. And so our agency, again, seemed very, very small in comparison. But given that, we have tried, I think, while I've been here, collectively to ensure that taxpayers do get value for the money that we spend. And we have tried, I think all of us around this table, to be very thoughtful and economical with the resources we've been given to try and ensure that we can achieve the maximum possible effect. And I think that we have been successful. And I think that you can measure that and you can see it in a very tangible way. The other thing that I believe that over the last 2 years the people that are sitting around me here at this table have tried to do is to prove conventional wisdom wrong. Because the conventional wisdom of this about what happens in this building is not very good. And I'm gonna focus for just a few minutes about enforcement, because that's an easy thing to measure. But generally, this agency is viewed as the toothless tiger or the sleeping watchdog or the fox guarding the chicken house or the wheel horse of the status quo or some other sort of awful animal metaphor. You know, we've heard them. We've heard it so often. And, you know, the enforcement is often characterized as slow, if it occurs at all, and that we're endlessly deadlocked in 3-3 votes, and that the agency is just frozen from doing its job by the very structure given to it by Congress. And yet I think the data proves conventional wisdom wrong. We are now wrapping up the second best year in enforcement in this agency's history. We have collected roughly $5.5 million in penalties this year. This is second only to last year, where we collected about $6.2 million in penalties. To put that in some kind of context, before the last 2 years, the highest this agency collected in a year in penalties was about $3.2 million. So we have almost doubled the best year this agency's ever had in the last 2 years consistently. Three of the five largest penalties in this agency's history came this year. Four of the top five came in the last 2 years. And we have done this at a time in which we are closing cases faster than ever before. We have shrunk the time it takes to close a case by 32% since 2002. Our numbers are 32% faster than they were in that year. And this is the product of a lot of hard work by people. I think it's a product of thinking very hard about how we do our work by folks and a willingness on the part of both the staff and the commissioners to make a lot of hard decisions and move a lot of cases very, very quickly. At the same time, this year we've done finished 25 audits. We did 18 last year. I think, simply put, enforcement at this agency is the strongest it has ever been in its history. Deadlocks, we're deadlocking less than 1% of our votes on enforcement matters. And so while I joked a little bit before about this being a place where bipartisanship works, I think the numbers bear that out. We do two other things that are important here. One is trying to clarify the law. We do that in part with regulations, and this year the people at this table, the staff in this building, have wrestled with and resolved two of the most central questions, two of the most central issues or questions that have, I was going to say plagued, but have been you know, part of this area of the law since this agency was created. The question of what kind of speech do we regulate and what kind of organizations do we regulate were both asked and answered this year. As to groups, in January we issued the E&J on what constituted political committees. For good or ill, we told people what we thought required you to register and report as a political committee. Today we issued the E&J on the Wisconsin Right to Life decision, 5 months after the Supreme Court issued that decision. We have been able to promulgate both rules and explanations for those rules about that. In addition, today we voted out the travel rules, only 3 months after Congress put that statute in place. At the same time, we have also worked through and put this agency in a position to issue final rules in three other important areas at the beginning of next year. We've got the bundling rulemaking ready for final decision-making. We've got the improvement in our ethics rules ready for decision, as well as hybrid ads teed up as well. And so this agency is well poised to begin next year and close out even more significant rulemaking. One of the things that we've started doing 2 years ago, and we've done an enormous amount of this year, is using policy statements to clarify the rules. We issued proposed or a pilot program on probable cause hearings. We got 7 requests. We held 4 hearings in secret here this year and issued that program in its final form. In the area of embezzlement, we put out both a policy statement as well as internal controls and guidance. I see Joe Stoltz there. He and his staff put in an enormous amount of time in trying to put together some clear guidance for political committees about the types of internal controls they needed to have in place to prevent embezzlement and the kinds of reductions in penalties that would be available to political committees that had certain kinds of protections in place and yet faced experienced embezzlement and the consequent enforcement or the disclosure violations that often came with those. We adopted a sua sponte policy to encourage people to self-report violations of the law and have begun implementing that in our enforcement cases, as well as providing a much clearer description of what we were doing when we closed out cases and providing guidance on how people should report their purposes of disbursements. We provided guidance about the law and advisory opinions. We did 35 advisory opinions, including 5 today. And so an enormous amount of work has been done in that area. And lastly, the third major function of this agency involves disclosure. And I think that if you go to our website today and use or look at the map-based search engine for contributions and expenditures, it is a dramatically better tool than what existed before. Before the end of the year, we hope to roll that out both for the House and Senate data as well as the presidential data that's available today. I guess my time is up. And I just think, I don't think this agency has seen as dramatic improvement in its in the searchability of its data since Congress went electronic in their filing. I think that that was an enormous improvement. Bob Biersack is sitting there. He put a lot of time into that. Joe Stoltz. A number of people in this building. The list is long. I'm sure everyone's growing weary, but I will end where I began, which is an enormous amount of work has been done in this agency this year. It did not just happen. That was the willingness of the people around this table. I want to acknowledge Petrina Clark, who has helped enormously. Tommy Duncan, among the things we've done, we hired a general counsel. We hired a deputy general counsel. We had hired heads of litigation and enforcement. I want to thank them. Lynn Frazier, our IG, we rarely acknowledge the inspector general. Lynn has played an enormously constructive and helpful role. Aaron Singenshook, our new CFO. The two of them, I think, did just great work along with Petrina in getting us a clean audit opinion this year, as well as improving the internal controls around the finances of this agency. And so there's that side of the business that's gone on here. I want to end there and prepare for the passing of this gavel on to Dave and Steve. I didn't want to do so without acknowledging how proud I am to have served with the other commissioners here, how grateful I am for the work of the staff, and how, in the end, successful I think we've been in achieving our mission this year. So with that, I move to the next item on the agenda, which is election of the officers. Mr. Vice Chairman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to note that every chairman brings a little different management style to the commission, and the chairman, and I guess he was thinking about this list a week or so ago when he talked to me, and he said, I can't think of anything that is just my responsibility. It's all been a team effort, and that is the nature of a multi-member agency. However, I just want to note that the long list of accomplishments that the chairman went through certainly were contributed to by the staff and to one greater or lesser degree by every commissioner, but many of those specific items and very particularly the overall volume of work is thanks to the vision and energy of the chairman. And we have rarely been blessed with a chairman who was willing to work so hard to accomplish not merely a particular personal agenda of his own, but an agenda for the commission to keep us focused, to keep us working, keep the staff directed. And I very much appreciate his efforts. I want to thank him for it, and I think all of us would feel we'd be remiss in not thanking the chairman and recognizing his signal part in all of these accomplishments.
Thank you. Next item on the agenda, election of officers. The first of those would be the election of the chairman. Commissioner Weintraub.
I've got a nomination. Before I do that, I really do want to echo what the vice chairman just said. You know, it's interesting, as some of you know, I've known Bob for many, many years, but it's different when you work with somebody day in and day out. You find out things about them that you never would know just from seeing them socially. I found out, for example, that Bob has this meticulous attention to detail that, you know, you wouldn't find out about somebody when you're ordering food in a restaurant. But there is really no aspect of this agency's functioning that Bob hasn't rolled up his sleeves and tried to, you know, delve into the weeds and figure out exactly how it works and how we can make it work better. And I think that the agency is working better in a lot of ways thanks to his efforts. So I just wanted to say that to my good old buddy before I place in nomination your successor. And I am honored and delighted to do that. David M. Mason has been serving as a commissioner of this agency since 1998, and he has served that time with great distinction. He's known throughout the building for his graciousness as well as for his intellect, a man for the quality of his heart as well as for the quality of his intellect. He's not, for technical reasons, a lawyer, but he knows the law as well as anyone in this building and perhaps anyone in this country. Before he came to the commission, he served as a senior fellow in Congressional Studies at the Heritage Foundation, a gentleman and a scholar. And before that, he was Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense and helped to guide base closing legislation to a successful conclusion. So that was, I think, good training for some of the negotiations that he's had since he's been here. He also served on Capitol Hill, first as legislative assistant to Senator John Warner, then working up the chain of command in the congressional office, legislative director to Representative Tom Bliley, and finally staff director, that's the big cheese, to then House Republican Whip Trent Lott. And he's also been active in a lot of political campaigns and has run for office himself, so his knowledge of politics is both broad and deep. But I want to point out a couple of personal things about Dave that are most striking to me. Dave was last chairman in 2002, which was a banner year for the commission because that's when BCRA passed, and the agency was faced with an extraordinary obligation to work like I think it had never worked in its history, to get out the soft money regs in 90 days and all the other regs within, was it 270 days? And I know, because I was outside the building then, that a lot of people outside the building did not think that that would get done, that those statutory deadlines would be met, but they were under Dave's leadership. But that wasn't enough for Dave, because not only did he lead the agency through its most hectic and busy and intensely scrutinized year in its history, probably, but that wasn't busy enough for him. So in the middle of that year, he taught himself Polish, took his entire family, his wife and six children, to Poland, and adopted four more children. As a parent of three, I often feel like, you know, I've got kind of a challenging household, and I will say that I'll match my three against most people's six, but at 10, you definitely have me outranked. I can't begin to imagine the logistics that go on in managing a household of 12 people. And his kids are all homeschooled. which leads me to the conclusion that the only person I know who may be more impressive than Dave is his wife, Margaret, who is a wonderful person, and I've had the pleasure of knowing her these last few years also. Actually, I think she may be more impressive than you are, Dave. But
I'll not dispute it.
Wise move. The other striking incident that's happened since I've known Dave is that, I don't know, maybe, I can't remember exactly when it was, might have been a year or two after he expanded his family. Dave awoke one night in the middle of the night to find that his house was on fire and was seriously ablaze and, in fact, burned to the ground within a very, very short period of time. And I think it's a tribute to the leadership and organizational skills that he and his wife bring to their family and have taught their children, and the caring that they have taught their children, that everyone cares for each other and looks out for each other, that despite the fact that they had very little time, all 12 of the people in that household got out safely that night, and the fire department, when they got there, was just bowled over by the efficiency with which they managed to get everybody out in those hectic circumstances in the middle of the night, and said that if they hadn't been as efficient as they had been, if they hadn't actually trained fire drills, I understand, which really impressed me, and I've since at least bought fire ladders for my house, which I understand came in handy that night, that they would not have had such a good result, and we're all thankful that they did. But, you know, he still, in the middle of all that, moved his family to temporary quarters, rebuilt his house, and had to buy everything all over again because they lost everything in the fire. And through all of that, he continued to work as diligently as ever, and we barely saw him miss a beat. So when I place Dave Mason's name in nomination as chairman of this commission, I am nominating a man who has been tested metaphorically and literally by fire. And I know that the agency will be in very, very able hands. It sounds like we've got an animal. Sorry. As I build to the climax, it sounds like there's something growling in here. What is that? I think I'd better quit while I'm ahead, Mr. Chairman. It's my distinct pleasure and honor to move the nomination of David M. Mason as chairman of the Federal Election Commission for 2008.
I guess there's some comfort in knowing the roofers are hard at work. Very good.
Or they're snoring up there. I don't know what that is.
Commissioner Weintraub has so moved. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none. All in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Weintraub's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-0, with myself, Commissioner Weintraub, Commissioners Walther, and Von Spakovsky voting in favor.
I just want to thank Commissioner Weintraub for that embarrassingly gracious nomination.
Okay. As to the position of vice chairman of the Federal Election Commission, Commissioner Von Spakovsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Actually, I thought that noise might be some of the political classes in town growling about the decisions we made here today.
Sounds like a bear.
I'm going to nominate the vice chairman. Before doing that, I want to thank you, Mr. Chairman, for your leadership this year, and point out that once again that under the leadership of Chairman Toner last year and your leadership this year, I think the FEC has had the two most successful years in its 32-year history, collecting the largest civil penalties ever, and all the other accomplishments you did. And that's only possible because of the great leadership in a bipartisan way that you exhibited. And I want to thank you for that. Commissioner Walther practiced law with a law firm that he co-founded in 1972 before moving to Washington to take up this position here. He's a former member of the Board of Governors of the ABA. He's currently their co-chair of the ABA Center for Human Rights. He was appointed by the ABA president to serve as the ABA representative to the UN and served on the executive board of the ABA Central European and Eurasian Law Initiative, which oversees the ABA's democracy program in over 21 countries. So not only has he been concerned about democracy in the United States, but has put a lot of his time and effort in helping build up democracies in other countries. He's also the former president of the State Bar of Nevada, the Western States Bar Conference, and the National Caucus of State Bar Associations. All of those
posts are posts that show the respect and esteem that his fellow lawyers hold him in. And all of those, I think, say a lot about how good of a lawyer he is. There is one other post I have to mention, which I think gives him the best experience in the world for the rough and tumble of the political world of Washington, and that's the fact that he's the former president of the Reno Rodeo Association. And I think the experience of the rough and tumble of bull riding is probably very similar to being a commissioner at the FEC. I want to say that having personally served with Commissioner Walther for the last 2 years, I can attest the fact that he's not only a very good lawyer, but he's an individual with a great deal of integrity who does his best to be fair and impartial in the work we do at this agency, which involves enforcing the law in one of the most sensitive and important areas of the First Amendment, which is the election process. He's
a lawyer's lawyer, and when I first got out of law school and started practicing, the first senior partner I worked for once told me, and I think it's very true, that if you can say of a lawyer that his word is his bond, and that you know that you can trust that he will say, he will do what he says he will do, that's the best kind of lawyer. And that describes Commissioner Walther, I think, to a T. It's been a privilege to serve with him, and it's a great honor to be able to nominate him to be vice chairman in 2008.
Very good. Discussion on the motion? Hearing none, all in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Madam Secretary, Commissioner Von Spakovsky's motion has been adopted by a vote of 4-0 with myself and the Vice Chairman and Commissioner Weintraub and Von Spakovsky voting in favor. Commissioner Walther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I want to deeply say how much I appreciate those very kind comments. It's often said that nomination speeches are exaggerated. I'm glad you've been willing to carry on with that tradition. And I deeply appreciate that. It's an honor to be nominated by you. I consider just being a commissioner a great honor. And I think I feel an obligation to say a few words right now about that. It wasn't an easy decision to come to Washington after practicing with a firm you formed for, my firm was in existence for 33 or 34 years, a wonderful group of people. I gave a lot of hard thought about doing that, what it would mean, what kind of contribution you could make, what the heck was this agency really about inside and out, and it was a very hard decision, and looking back, it's one I never would have missed. It's been a wonderful opportunity to meet some great people and do the best you can. It's been very valuable things and chores that were assigned. To say a word of special respect for our chairman, Bob Lenhardt, because this year he was tasked with some very hard issues to cause us to focus on, and at the same time he was inclined to want to innovate and do some new things that I think have really made a difference in the way, the quality of the way we do our work. This is not a derogation of former Chairman Toner. I happen to think he was a wonderful chairman and a very diplomatic, bright man who saw us through some very difficult issues with great finesse and was a wonderful way to see leadership at the very outset of walking in the door here. But this year has been especially difficult. We've been through these tough issues. We've been faced with a number of challenges and some new fiscal opportunities. We've really, in the Commissioner Weintraub's initiation over the years, I'm told, really brought some new issues that have been long dormant to the head and voted on them, open hearings being one, best efforts, policy directives to provide greater guidance to the community that's being regulated in addition to the daily work that we do. So it's been a very nice opportunity to have a chance to be led by him this year. I want to thank Commissioner Weintraub for really serving as an early mentor here and convincing me that this is a pretty good spot. And when I came here to decide really kind of how this agency worked and take a look at the inside, this was the first face that I met, that smiley face, and really has been a wonderful person to work with, but I want to thank her for the initiation that she gave me that caused it to be a major factor in being here. It's going to be a great year of leadership under Chairman Mason. I think he'll probably try and run us like he does his family. I think we'll find a lot of organizational skills be brought to bear on us, much needed. He's got a great way about him to see a way to find compromise without sacrificing principle. It's been amazing to me to see someone look at the broader impact of some of these very complicated regulations and think of policies he was talking about today down the pike. And it's going to be very interesting to see him bring us through after some major transition has occurred. I want to also say that the Commissioner Von Spakovsky has been a terrific person to work with. I find him to be a very fine commissioner. He knows the law. He thinks the law. He gives very cogent arguments. Those of you who have sat here day in and day out understand that he has really a great ability to focus on important issues and cause us to focus on them as well. And it's also been very enjoyable to work with him because if you ask the commissioner how he stands on an issue, you usually find out very quickly, and this is good. You learn where you can make compromise, where it's not possible, and to go on from there, and that's been a real pleasure. One more thing that I think is important to mention in this particular context is how much we value the people outside the community to help give us a direction that works. And you've seen us, especially the last two meetings, for example, respond very dramatically to the input that we have received from the community. We value that opinion greatly, and it may seem frustrating to many of the people who write to us and give opinions and criticize us to think that we really are immune to that, but that's not the case. I mean, we really do pay attention to the people outside these walls and look to them for guidance, and sometimes very quickly we'll find ourselves taking a 180-degree turn just because of that. As I said before the Senate committee in our hearing in June 13th, I think, one of the finest experiences I had is to find out what a great staff we have here. To the person, it's been a great experience for me to see how a federal agency can work in such a wonderful way with fine people who've been here forever, Mary Dove, and people who, we learn to work with day in and day out, and Joe Stoltz and others who have given their career and the best of their years. Not that there's not plenty left to this great agency, and so it's been really one of the finest experiences I've had, and I want to thank personally Brad Deutsch, who's been my EA, and since I was a freshman here, he led me graciously through the thickets of agency policies and processes and politics, and as well as through the other issues that we've had to face. And I think we have overlooked on occasion, because we are constantly giving press releases about what we're doing internally, and the chairman touched on that, and the Chairman Mason, but really we have done, there's really no stone has been left unturned in terms of trying to figure out how to improve our agency internally. And I think a lot has been done. I can't compare it with previous years, but I'm convinced from looking at it that this last 12 months and 24 months has really changed the way we do business and will in the future. We have new people at our leadership. Patrina Clark has reorganized a number of these agencies in a very sensible way to give greater responsibility and line of control. We have a new CFO who responds directly to us. We have a new, as we know, general counsel. We have revised all of our internal directives that have been really unchanged for almost 30 years. Most of them have been adopted over 30 years ago. They're all undergoing new scrutiny. We've completely tightened up our financial oversight over the way we do business. We've set internal goals. All these things are not noticed by the outside, but they really have made us a much better agency. And the last comment I'll make is really one about the value of this agency. I think Commissioner Von Spakovsky mentioned the fact that I've had experience in providing technical assistance to other countries, and there is no country that I've
had experience with, and that's been over the years, who wouldn't look with great envy in their country of an agency like ours who provides total transparency or great transparency over the way money operates in campaigns. And most people in most civilized countries or otherwise cannot believe the great function that this provides in a budding democracy or even a mature democracy. And the transparency really is the bedrock of the success of any democracy, I'm convinced. And this agency plays one of the most pivotal roles in our country and is a great I think, beacon of hope for other countries. So I would like to see our role continue to be effective in that and really advance our role, maybe working with other governments or other agencies within our government to give greater technical assistance to other countries to show what really can be done here. So once again, I apologize for the length of this, but I think the opportunity for me was necessary to say a few words, and thank you once again for the confidence in voting me to be vice chair.
Good. Thank you. Other comments, thoughts, suggestions? We turn to our last item on the agenda, which is management administrative matters. Ms. Clark, are there any such matters to handle today?
Well, I have a few comments, so I thought I would wait for this agenda item to make those comments. Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. I wanted to thank you for your kind expressions earlier and acknowledging all of the hard work of all the staff and all the commissioners who also took the time to make those comments. We really appreciate the support and the leadership that you and all of the other commissioners have given to the staff this year. I think, as has been noted, we've made some pretty significant accomplishments in terms of how we're managing and administering the practices of this agency, and that is a testament to your leadership and the support of the full commission in making sure that this agency really is the best that it possibly can be. So I wanted to thank you for your leadership and the other commissioners for their support throughout this year. I'd also like to extend congratulations to Chairman-elect Mason and Vice Chairman-elect Walther. We look forward to working with you to continue building upon our past successes, as noted over the last couple of years, and to continue the positive momentum that's really, I think, come into full swing under current Chairman Linhard's leadership. And finally, I would like to extend best wishes for a happy and joyous holiday season to all.
Good. Thank you. And with that, we bring the meeting to a close. For the staff and the commissioners, we will reconvene at 3:30 to have a hopefully reasonably short executive session.